The good, the bad, and the alternative. By Madame Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of Andrew Hussey. Chapter 21. Mankind Now Dreams. Rose. Rose dreamt of summer. The strawberries fruiting. The vaporing summer storms, the scintillation of fireflies. She stood in a grassy field somewhere in rural New York, the kind of place she was certain she'd seen, but could not put a time nor location to. Black clouds rolled quickly overhead, but no rain fell, only gusts of hot wind that threatened to shake her hair free of its band. The fireflies that danced in the distance seemed to flash in concert, one after the other in a hypnotic pattern that Rose was lost in. Then, suddenly, they all went out at once. Rose turned her head to find more, but everywhere her gaze fell, the insects were snuffed. A deep, unabiding sense of dread fell over Rose, as dark as a starless night. Her mind reached for something, anything to anchor her and pull her mind from the dreadful shadow. She balled her hands into fists as the darkness grabbed at her heart and found something digging into her palm, the edges and valleys of knuckle bones. She looked at the dice in her hand. The runes scarred upon the bone were glowing with an impossible radiance. As if in answer, she felt a slash of cold biting the side of her ribs, her wound. The rays of pale blue light it was emitting shone through her shirt. All at once, the dread vanished. Rose heard a noise behind her, clucks of disapproval. She whirled around, the bones in her hands clutched as if she could somehow weaponize them, instead of some monstrous dream threat, though she saw a woman. The black clouds parted, allowing a singular ray of sun to come down on her like a spotlight. She was slight and absolutely diminutive relative to Rose. But the height at which she carried herself and Rose's own slouch brought the level of their heads closer than anticipated. She was considering something in her hand, holding it up to the light. Rose saw a tiny squirming darkness trapped between two of the woman's fingerprints like a worm in a bird's beak. The woman squeezed the slithering thing. And instead of squishing, as Rose might have imagined, a sharp crack sounded out, like ice shattering. And the blackness fragmented, the resultant tenebrous particles drifting away into nothing in the light. As though in concert, the sensation on her side changed, shifting from impossible cold to comforting warmth. The light changed with it, a golden glow now radiating from her.
Deep magic,
the woman said derisively. Rose heard her words, but not her voice. The meaning simply seemed to be conveyed, pitchless, unaccented.
Such a butcherly use of chaos.
The woman's eyes turned to her, and Rose could no longer see a face, or maybe she never could. Just a burning white glow that seemed to consider her. Rose averted her eyes, looking down instead at the grass. As if by luck, her gaze fell on a four-leafed clover, then another, and another. Every piece of green beneath Rose's feet was a four-leafed clover.
So you're the flickering little flame that sparked up, hmm? The resident really ought to be more careful as she leaves her spores.
Rose sucked in a breath. Flooding her mind unbidden were visions of the ritual, the eldritch onslaught and the whipping, wayward tentacle that lashed her. The oily shimmer that formed in place of a scab. The woman spoke again.
Yes, a pure physical manifestation of a greater being. To survive touching the unknown. What is it you all say down here? The abyss stares back at you.
The woman's light burned into Rose, worse than the worst sunburn she'd ever received. As though she were a mere insect trapped under a magnifying glass.
Lucky for you, little flame, I can offer you a choice. Instead of that commitment to the void.
Rose saw the woman's legs step forward. Then her hands lightly took Rose's own, unfurling them to let the dice roll between her palms.
You don't have to make any sort of choice now. This is a dream, after all. But consider it.
The dice grew hot, and Rose yanked her hands back. They fell, each landing amongst the clovers, the light of the markings shining up at her. 5, Keon. The woman's arms crossed, and the light of her head seemed to tip in thought.
Not even conscious and yet channeling. Perhaps there is more on this speck worth nurturing than I'd anticipated.
Rose felt like she was on a microscope slide, being viewed through a lens by an entity of incomprehensible scale. She choked, but could not get words out.
My apologies, but I simply came to observe and inform. I'm sure we'll find a space in which to speak another time. For now, only remember the important feelings, won't you?
The woman's hand came up in a fluttering wave of farewell.
Dream sweet.
Rose dreamt of summer. The strawberries fruiting, the vaporing summer storms, the scintillation of firefly. She felt balmy gales sending her hair aflutter, ensconced as she was in the dappled shade of a young oak. The blanket beneath her was soft, and though the grass tickled her legs, which extended past the length of it, she was comfortable. Beside her was a beautiful girl, rich dark hair, a quick, bright smile. The girl leaned over Rose and kissed her gently. The soft, tender passion in the meeting of their lips set her aflame inside. She tasted like honey. The girl began to pull away, and Rose lurched after her in shameful desperation, needing just a second more of that bliss. But the girl just placed one strong hand on Rose's chest and giggled, a laugh that was distinctly not Kanaya's. A beam of sun glimmered through the branches above, glinting off of a pair of round glasses as Rose saw jade pulling away from her, the sweetest smile on her lips, the deepest fondness in her eyes. Rose! Rose's eyes blasted open as though she was trying to toss a shot put with her eyelids, her fading dream mixed with reality as she saw jade's face hovering over hers. Was what Rose managed to coerce out of her freshly awoken vocal cords as she rolled away, propelled by panic across the bed. Her heart hammered in her chest. The dream she'd just had it felt real. She still felt the ghost of the pressure on her lips, the phantom sensation of grass tickling her legs. A whisper of something else, something dreamlike, drifted through the back of her mind but disappeared before she could grab it. Had she dreamt of something else? More immediate concerns demanded her attention before she could think on it, namely the face of the girl she'd been dreaming of canoodling, looking upon her scrambling with obvious concern.
"Sorry," Jade said penitently. "It looked like you were having a bad dream. You were sweating and moving your mouth a lot."
Rose's face somehow managed to grow hotter.
"And I think I have something important that I read in the journal that you might want to know."
At this, Jade looked hesitant, afraid even Rose couldn't fathom of what.
You read further in the journal?" Rose asked. "Not by much," Jade said. "Not even through the first entry, just a little bit more, and I couldn't sleep," she insisted.
"Well, what did you discover?" Rose asked, doing her best to push the dream out of memory. The potential for esoteric secrets was aiding with the endeavor, slighted as she was, that Jade read ahead without her. Rose reached to the bedside table and flipped the lamp on, casting Jade's face in an appropriately dramatic yellow light. Rose heard a huff and a thump from near Jade's feet, where she could only assume Beck, the apparent god, was pitifully protesting the interruption of his nap. Jade slid down to her knees, reaching down to assuage him with a pat.
"My grandpa, who he was..."
Jade sighed and leaned her elbows on the bed, her head in the crook, almost as if in prayer. Rose knit her brows.
who he was in reference to. I guess it's more about who my grandma was, Jade said, her voice trailing off as she frowned. Rose just gestured for her to go on. I do not possess enough context to probe further, Jade, please. Okay, Grandpa said he wasn't my grandpa, and that he was actually my dad. So my dad said, wrote, that his mom was a goddess. She paused, then reiterated, the goddess. Rose could hear the capitalization, noting that there must be some significance behind the title, Jade continued. Making my grandmother the goddess, my dad a half-god, my actual grandfather some kind of wizard, and me a demigod, Rose said, unable to keep a slight note of awe from her voice. Jade, you mean to tell me your arcane abilities stem from the blood of true immortals flowing in your veins? Don't say it like that. Jade turned her head away. Rose's mind was already flooding with the possibilities. She'd already intended to learn all she could from Jade, but this was an entirely new dimension, something even her mother couldn't have known the limits of. Suddenly, the purpose of her mother's experiments felt a lot more clear. She squirmed across the bed, and went across the room to her pile of knitting supplies. After rooting around amidst loose yarn for a moment, she produced a large, heavy book titled Knitting Patterns on the unadorned black cover. Her personal grimoire, a collection of all the most important discoveries she'd made and the broad strokes of each concept she learned of. The hunter hadn't found this one. Rose sat on the bed, cross-legged, between the pillows and where Jade kneeled, and flipped to one of the few remaining blank pages she wrote. In large letters across the top, Jade. Demigod. 1/4. What can you tell me about your relationship with your mother? Grandmother, rather, Rose asked. Jade put her face in the blanket and groaned.
This isn't some psychological thing, Rose, she said, muffled.
Rose allowed a slight smile to cross her features. I'm aware. I simply wanted to speak the phrase. But the question stands, what do you know about your godly heritage?
Next to nothing.
Jade turned her head out from the blankets, looking annoyed. I assume Grandpa and Dr. Lalonde didn't teach me about greater gods for the sake of safety or something dumb. Like I'd be safer if I didn't know I had family elsewhere. Oceans of bitterness underlaid Jade's dismissive tone. This may not have been a therapy session, but Rose was making note of it. As well as the way Jade had referred to her father as Grandpa, she must have been struggling with the paradigm shift. Jade clambered off her knees and sat in the bed a mere 6 inches away, her legs dangling off the edge. She removed her glasses to wipe off the smear her face had made on them. Rose couldn't help but stare. Jade's face looked so different without the big, round frames breaking up the lines of her cheekbones and the bridge of her nose. She looked more mature. The set of her brow and the slight frown she wore was almost intimidating. Rose was reminded of the years before the catastrophe, when Jade's seniority and age was justification for much of her advice and warnings. Rose wondered what it might take to get her to act in that authoritative manner again.
Is there something on my face? Jade asked.
Rose realized she'd been staring a moment too long. Just reading your expression in regards to your father, your feelings towards him, in the strange context of posing as your grandfather, would be an interesting case study, Rose said. Jade hesitated for a moment, then nodded.
I guess so. The god stuff would probably make us an outlier, though. I mean, I would think so, but who knows how many kids and family lines are descended from all these gods running around? Even if the small ones stopped laying with humans after the secrecy was instituted, that would still leave a ton of possibility for extended lineages. Oh, gee, do you think the gods are going to start romancing humans again now that the secrecy is over?
Perhaps the journal would grant us that answer, Rose asked. Jade sighed.
Maybe. Who knows if anything in here is even true or just another set of lies to keep me safe, supposedly, Jade said morosely. It's just, even complaining about it is getting tiring. My apologies. Would you say your magical tutelage was more nurturing of an inner strength or technical knowledge and memorization? Rose asked.
If she couldn't squeeze any meaningful information about Jade's heritage, she might as well collect some information on the practical performance of magic. Jade's eyes darted down and left.
I've never really thought about it, but technical knowledge, I think. But I get the feeling I was using some sort of easy mode.
She flexed her hand in front of her face, and a few motes of sparkling green light started bobbing around in a circle above her palm.
I don't think it's as simple as a magic word for most wizards. You heard my unlocking spell.
It phonetically resembled the structure of a Harry Potter spell, I will say, Rose said, making a note on the page.
Jade believes her ability to use magic is, quote, easy and, quote, simple compared to, quote, most wizards. She cites her unlocking spell, quote, Sephra Discarpa, as an example.
I went the spell around the same time you were reading those. I couldn't help but take a little inspiration.
Jade kicked her legs back and forth, an action that drew Beck's eye as well as Rose's own.
I don't think real wizards get to cheat like that.
The sparkles in Jade's hand started glowing brighter. She seemed to notice it and quickly closed her fists, snuffing the lights.
And I don't think wizards have problems with spells overcharging all the time.
Jade resummoned the motes, and while they remained a constant low light, they spun so quickly around Jade's palm that it looked like there was some sort of light hoop in her hand.
Overcharged? Rose asked. Is that why you disassembled my chair when you unlocked my handcuffs? Yeah, I don't know why, though. But ever since I woke up, all of my magic does way more than I want it to. I tried a simple finding spell, and I think my compass is going to track Dr. Lalonde's location for the rest of time. And when I was fighting those vampires, my shield... Sorry.
Rose interrupted the rush of stress-tinged words. Fighting those vampires? Jade blew out her cheeks and suddenly looked guilty.
Yeah. There was a lot that happened after I came back from Faerie. I ended up in some mountains near one of Dr. Lalonde's labs, and I accidentally stumbled into a pack of vampires after I got lost and sent back to find the nearest town. The worst part about the shield was that it knocked me over. I guess it also blasted the heck out of that vampiric centaur. But I wish a shield spell didn't hurt me, you know?
They were trying to kill you? Rose asked, horrified. Her mind presented Vriska lunging at her, fangs long and gleaming, toxic yellow venom flying from her mouth. She recalled the deep, bone-aching bruises Kanaya had left on John.
Jade had been attacked by a pack of them? Well, they definitely wanted to drink my blood. I suppose it's possible they would have kept me alive for future meals, but I wasn't about to take any chances. Grandpa always said surrender was just a way to prolong your death. Being a walking blood bag, he's shown me autopsy reports. It isn't pretty, Jade said.
Rose recalled the rifle strapped to Jade's duffel when she arrived at the basement lab.
Jade, did you kill those vampires?
Rose asked hesitantly.
Only a couple,
Jade said defensively.
A hunter ended up arriving and I think he took care of the rest. It was just self-defense.
Rose would need to make sure she introduced Jade to some coping skills. Whatever her father slash grandfather had been training her for clearly involved some level of moral desensitization. Only a couple indeed.
So in regards to your magic,
Rose tried to change the subject.
It has only been backfiring since you left Faerie? Yes.
Jade threw up her hands in frustration.
I'm trying to get a handle on it, but the power just feels like I'm level 80 and I just got sent back to the tutorial zone. Everything is overkill.
Rose considered the situation. Her first time off of her home island, where her father was doing his best to train her and keep her safe, she'd read about methods of dampening magic lead, salt, iron. Perhaps while you were on your island, your father devised some method of, forgive the juvenile metaphor, training wheel mechanism? Rose recalled the brief stint during which John and Dave were equally obsessed with Naruto and demanded the quartet partake in a group watch party. The scene involving the shedding of ankle weights felt relevant. Jade's eyes narrowed at that.
I don't know, she said. Every time I open that journal, it's like I can feel him watching over my shoulder. It's hard.
Rose glanced over at the journal on the desk, slightly frustrated at how close the answers to these questions might be. She wouldn't intrude on what was Jade's to share. That was her family and her secrets, regardless of Rose's hunger for knowledge. As though on cue, her stomach made a horrible noise of protest. Jade giggled, breaking the gloomy atmosphere.
Should we order something? She asked.
Rose clapped her grimoire shut. The only additional note she'd taken was regarding the irregular vibrancy of Jade's eyes.
Yes, I believe the last thing I ate was a fast food hamburger of middling quality on Sunday, Rose said, recalling the misery of the road trip. Great, I think I saw some menus stuck to your fridge next to the money.
Jade bounced out of the room, perfectly unimpeded by the spell that kept Rose interred.
Demigod,
Rose whispered again to herself. Maybe she wasn't as hopelessly imprisoned as she thought. John. Well, I think Vampire's Kiss is more realistic than you give it credit for, Vriska said as she stirred a small bowl of cherry butter under John's watchful eye. A cruel, powerful woman who makes her victim hallucinate and hurt people. It sounds like textbook desert vampire behavior, if you ask me. She gave the bowl a final stir, then tilted it at John. He paused in his own stirring of a small bowl of coconut batter. Plucking her abandoned spoon from her bowl, he carefully ran it through the cherry batter, checking the consistency. Much better than the last batch. You're getting the hang of this fast, he grinned at her. But I still think Cage does better when he plays the badass, realism or not. What about Ghost Rider? How's that one rank for a certified expert? Of course I'm getting the hang of it. I'm great at everything. She stepped away from her bowl to retrieve the butter-soaked paper towel, then began greasing one of the empty cupcake pans like he'd shown her. I actually never got to see that one. The Vegas blockbuster I was allowed to steal from only stocked his older stuff, and Salix always wanted me to eavesdrop on any visitors as payment when he sent me digital files. Don't forget to dust the corners with flour or else they'll stick, he warned her. The oven's timer was going off, so he grabbed two toothpicks and an oven mitt before replying. That sucks. I mean, it sucks that you didn't get to see it. Not that your friend was helping you get a hold of Cage's newer flicks. As he cracked the oven open, the smell of vanilla and raspberry wafted up. As promised, they were making a bunch of mini-batches. And this tray was long enough to hold a dozen cupcakes, so he decided to make two flavors at once. He carefully stuck the first toothpick in one of the vanillas at random, then did the same for a raspberry. Both came out clean, so he pulled the tray from the oven, carefully resting under the counter next to a few other cooling batches. Are you sure I have to wait until they're frosted? Vriska wheedled him. They all smell so good. She'd finished prepping the cupcake tray and now lurked over the various flavors on display. Between her hauntingly hollow cheeks and the way she sniffed the cupcakes longingly, he was beginning to feel a little bad for insisting they didn't try any yet. I don't want you to miss out on the full experience, he said firmly. My Nana always told me that presentation is important, and details are the difference between a good treat and a delicious dessert. Let's get these next two in the tray, and then I'll whip up some frosting for the salted caramels, okay? Those ones are probably cool by now. He was pretty sure they'd made the caramel cupcakes first, and it had definitely been long enough for them not to risk melting the buttercream. When you say stuff like that, you remind me of Kanaya. She always goes on and on and on about presentation and details, especially when talking about her sewing projects. You should see the mods she begged Salix and Nepeta to make together for her bat mitzvah present a few months ago, just so she could put Zoe in some more stylish outfits and Left 4 Dead. As she spoke, she began carefully spooning her cherry batter into the cupcake tray. John barely hid a frown as she watched her talk about Kanaya, the sparkle in her eyes evident. He wasn't religious, but he was pretty sure the mitzvah thing happened when people turned 13. Vriska must have forgotten what year it was again. He didn't want to tell her that, worried she might get upset again. Well, Kanaya is your best friend or something, so I'll take the comparison as a compliment. He moved over to the caramel cupcakes and began slowly wiggling them from their tray onto a plate for easier frosting. Are zombies real too? Is Kanaya a good gamer? He stumbled, only barely stopping himself from asking if Kanaya was a zombie. Jeez, he needed to think more and talk less. Real smooth, dummy. She snorted at him, but it was one of those sarcastic, good humor sounds, so he was pretty sure she didn't mean it. I bet Aradia could tell us about zombies. She's kind of a nerd for that stuff. But Kanaya's no mindless monster. She's... And here Vriska's voice dropped reverently. Some kind of miracle. She paused, as if embarrassed by her own words, then threw off another sentence in an airy, casual tone. I bet Gamzee thinks she's Jesus' second coming and everything. At this point, the cherry cupcake batter was ready to go, and she eagerly snatched the abandoned coconut batter to spoon that into the tray as well. John figured she probably had it handled and began gathering the milk, butter, powdered sugar, and vanilla extract for the frosting. Wait, is Jesus real too? Is he secretly a zombie but a nice one? A horrifying image came to John's mind as he spoke. Like his imagination had a life of its own, Jesus nailed to the cross, wearing a crown of thorns that burned in his hair, grinning as blood dripped down his face and into his mouth. Behind him, another cross collapsed into a bloody pile, while a third one held a man who screamed as a snarling, blood-covered figure lurched closer. Jesus laughed, low and cruel, the sound echoing in his mind and making the strange heat under his skin flare up in response. No clue. I'm Egyptian, not Israeli. I could tell you more about Osiris if you wanted to know about the zombie gods. Her voice cut through the what was that, some kind of creepy daydream? He wasn't sure. Whatever it was, it faded when she spoke, and the weird sensations went with it. I think I'll save that story for when Dave gets here, he responded absently, realizing that the stick of butter he'd been warming between his hands was so soft it was trying to melt out of the wrapper. He quickly shook the runny mess into the frosting bowl. He'd probably be mad if I let him miss out on something like that. Total nerd behavior. I guess it's a good thing Kanaya introduced him to Aradia, if that's the sort of lame shit he's into. Hey, he protested, trying to defend Dave's honor. Dave can be cool sometimes, and archaeology is badass. Indiana Jones, Lara Croft, Nathan Drake, oh, and Ben Gates from National Treasure, it's super cool. Only like two of those guys are actually archaeologists. She looked up from the batter, waggling her eyebrows with a grin. It sounds to me like you've got a bit of a soft spot for Dave. His mouth stumbled over false starts as his mind scrambled. Well, he's my best friend, like you are with Kanaya. His comment made her flush, but she was quick to cover, replying to him in a sing-song voice as she matched his word choice. Well, what about Rose? You took a flying leap at Kanaya trying to keep her safe. If Dave's your best friend, what's she to you? He'd expected more vitriol in her voice when she said Rose's name. Instead, the girl was gazing at him intently. It was a little unnerving, but he was pretty sure that was just her face, not any special powers. Well, she's my other best friend. I couldn't let her do something dumb like that, even if some people thought she deserved it. Plus, Kanaya's my friend, too. She would be really upset if she hurt Rose when she was... He waved his hand in a vague sense, unsure what to say. When she was going curse crazy. She pulled the spoon free from the batter, sniffing it curiously. All right, fine. She probably wouldn't be happy if she'd snapped out of it with her stupid girlfriend's blood in her hands. For a moment, he thought she was going to lick the spoon, but thankfully, she simply began divvying up the batter into the other half of the cupcake tray. Rose isn't stupid, she just fucked with one of the most dangerous types of magic ever. You're excused, because you don't know any better, but any alt could tell you not to fuck with chaos. She's lucky it was for Fairy's mom and not something worse. She grimaced, and her grip on the spoon went white-knuckled tight. I don't know why everyone expected us to know it was dangerous. He scowled, attacking the thick frosting more aggressively. I watched Dave translate it. He told me that none of it sounded evil. People can be dangerous without being evil, she said absently. But I'm pretty sure all gods are evil, chaotic and orderly. The ones I've met haven't been kittens in sunshine, that's for sure. She looked down at her spoon, then discarded it in the now empty bowl, instead taking the tray of cupcakes and placing them in the oven. Okay, that's definitely bait. He added a little bit of vanilla extract to the frosting as he continued. I already said I don't want to hear any really cool or creepy stories about ancient god stuff without Dave, or else I risk breaking best bro code. He didn't want to imagine Dave being disappointed at him for learning about archaeology type stuff without him. Wait, could he call it archaeology if the ancient Egypt gods were apparently still around? It probably still counted, somehow, he'd have to ask. You're not fooling me with all that best bro talk. Each time you say it, it only proves that you've got the hots for Dave. You care so much about his opinion. It's adorable. John felt the heat of a blush rising in his cheeks as Vriska's tone shifted from girlish to sultry. I bet you want to sit in the back row of a movie theater with him and make out during the action scenes, am I right? He did everything to avoid her gaze, certain she was waggling her eyebrows again. She made a smooching noise, clearly having a blast getting a rise out of him as he clenched his jaw and stiffened his shoulders. The frosting was definitely ready, so he tried to busy himself by loading it into a frosting bag and piping it into a perfect swirl on the caramel cupcakes. The memories of his Nana were old and fuzzy, but he could remember her soft hands, dark and wrinkled with age, guiding him through the motions of frosting a cupcake. He cherished those memories and fought to hold on to them. Baking helped. Unfortunately, the recipient of these prime baked goods was starting to piss him off. You're being a total jerk right now, he snapped at her. I don't have a crush on Dave. Why would I want to kiss him? He's not even a girl. He stuttered as he spoke, tripping over his words. His face was hot, uncomfortably so, and the frosting he was piping began to run as he squeezed the bag too tight. He hastily put it aside, not wanting to ruin the cupcakes, even though she was being a total jerk. Talking about his best friend like that, she didn't know Dave. Hadn't heard the ways he talked about bitches and hoes in his raps. She didn't know John either. Accusing him of being homosexual made him feel like he was being watched, being judged. She took a sharp breath as if to retort, but he was mad now and wanted to snap back. You're a hypocrite. I'm not the one who's gay for my best friend. I saw how you looked at Kanaya, how you were begging for her to bite you. I bet you wanted her to... He scrambled for the words, then finished triumphantly. To kiss your neck or something!
Well, better me than Rose!
She shouted back at him, her face immediately colored. What? John shouted in confusion. What? Friska shouted back, sounding equally confused. She crossed her arms and scowled at him, her face getting even more flushed. The oven beeped, and she immediately turned away to yank it open aggressively, the oven door bouncing with the force. She snatched up the oven mitt and pulled out the cupcakes, placing the tray on the counter next to all the rest. John swallowed. After a moment of silence, he spoke up. Should we pretend this conversation didn't happen? No, that would be stupid. Just... Her mouth contorted as she found the words. You don't say anything to Kanaya. I don't say anything to Dave. He felt a rush of relief, and his right hand moved on impulse. Why are you sticking your pinky in my face? John leaned his pinky at her more aggressively. Pinky promise.
What's that?
You're joking, right? He searched her face for humor, but she gave a weak, sheepish smile in response. My only IRL friends were a half-feral werecougar and an uptight centaur aristocrat. I don't think pinky promises are something any of us has experience with. She looked a bit embarrassed, so he figured it couldn't hurt to share. Oh, I haven't had much experience with normal friendships either, I guess. Until we moved here, I pretty much only had internet friends. But a pinky promise is, like, super sacred. It's not magic or anything, but it signals you really, really mean it. I won't say anything to Kanaya, I pinky promise. We just touch pinkies to seal the deal. She slowly extended her own hand, pinky extended, until the tip of her finger brushed against his. It didn't look like the movies or anything, but it was good enough for him. All right, I pinky promise I won't say anything to Dave. She looked him in the eye for a moment, then darted her gaze downward to the cupcakes. Can I have a cupcake now? Grateful for the change of topic, he looked down at the cupcakes as well. He'd managed to frost 4 of the 6 caramel cupcakes, so he spun the plate, bringing the 2 unfrosted cupcakes closer to himself and presenting the frosted ones for her. Heck yeah, you can. Her gaze darted forward, swiping one of the cupcakes off the plate so fast that he almost jerked in surprise. She opened her mouth as wide as it would go and took a huge bite out of the cupcake, frosting and crumbs smearing on her mouth. She grinned at him, her cheeks bulging with cupcake, and he wanted a burst of laughter at the sight. It was while he was laughing, while she was busy chewing her overly ambitious mouthful, that the door opened. They both looked over to see Dad step inside and Dave following after. The smell of cleaning chemicals clung to them.
How's she been busy?
Dave let out a whistle of appreciation as he looked at the counter.
Damn, Egbert made one hell of a housewife.
From behind him, he heard the sound of Riska sputtering in aborted laughter. Dad frowned at Dave's words. Suddenly, John was very much aware of the apron he was wearing. Riska had his own apron on, a modern blue apron, the kind that tied behind the neck and looked kind of like overalls. Not wanting to use Dad's favorite apron, he'd ended up wearing one of Nana's aprons, which was the old-timey kind that looked like a flower-patterned dress with frilly shoulders and everything. It was a bit housewifey, he guessed. The thought warmed his cheeks, and he looked down, studying the cupcakes, unsure how to reply.
Now, Dave, I'm sure you don't mean to imply that John is anything less than a talented young man with that comment. Baking is a time-honored tradition in this family, and a skill every bright young man should learn, Dad spoke up.
Totally, Mr. E. John's got mad skills, I'm just poking fun.
John looked back up at his friend and smirked, picking up a cupcake to waggle at him.
You better be joking, dude, or else you won't get first dibs on one of these bad boys. We've made a bunch of flavors and have 2 more to go, and if you're not careful, you'll be waiting for crumbs.
Dave immediately flung himself to the floor in a dramatic posture, kneeling and clasping his hands as he scooted on his knees towards him.
You are the baking overlord, and I'm but a humble supplicant. Watch me grovel so hard that kings and princes everywhere feel like they just lost their best peasant. That's how fucking contrite I am to fan the one true emperor of baked goods. Move over, Ginger Betty. Faint in terror, Betty Crocker. Unplug your easy bake, Baker Betty. Bettys everywhere have lost their place in baking history. There's a new boss in town, and he's baking cement shoes for anyone who dares stand in his way. I'm unworthy, dog. A talentless chump with no head for the baking arts.
At this point, he had scooted close enough to John and consequently the counter that he could look up at the rows of cupcakes with interest.
Got any cherry up in there?
John looked down at his friend, kneeling at his feet, and...
Fuck, did Dave usually look like he was wearing lipstick? His lips were so plush.
And with his sunglasses pushed up on his head, his face was uncharacteristically exposed, revealing a rare glimpse of his eyes. Eyes that seemed to bore into him, pinning him in place. Dave swallowed, and John's eyes flashed down to his neck, watching his Adam's apple bob with the motion.
We made cherry, but I get first dibs. We're trying to figure out what my favorite flavor is.
Vriska's voice cut through the sudden silence, and it felt like a spell had been broken. His eyes no longer glued to Dave, drinking him in. He plastered a grin on his face and offered the non-cupcake hands to his friend.
"Dude, you're killing me right now. Get up before you lose any more cool kid points."
He heard his dad chuckle, and when he looked over, he caught a glimpse of his fond smile.
"All right, kids, have fun in there, and don't forget to clean up. I'm going to rinse off, then I'll be in my room sending emails. Shout if you need anything."
"Thanks, Mr. E, will do,"
Dave said as he took John's offered hand and pulled himself to his feet. He could feel Dave's calluses, rough against his own smooth palm. They both hesitated for a moment, before both letting go at once. John quickly shoved the cupcake forward instead.
"This one is salted caramel, if you don't want to wait. I already had one from that batch, and it is fucking delicious, better than chocolate for sure,"
Vriska offered. Dave hesitated a moment, eyes flicking between the cupcake in John's hand and the rose on the counter.
"What are the other ones you made?"
John turned slightly, pointing at each tray of cupcakes as he listed them off.
"The first one was salted caramel, the second one is lemon, and then we have peach. Then that tray has both vanilla and raspberry, then that tray has both coconut and cherry. We also plan to make two more flavors, blueberry and key lime, but we also still have to frost the rest of them. We're putting a plain vanilla buttercream on them all, since that goes with everything, except the lemon and lime. I'm making meringue frosting for those."
"I'm not eating all of them," Vriska volunteered, "just sampling. We're bringing the rest to Equius's party."
"You know what? I'll wait for cherry. You and your apprentice look like you could use another set of hands. Point me at a bowl, of Master Baker, and I'll stir like I'm some kind of..."
Vriska's snort of laughter stopped him in his tracks.
"Master Baker,"
she repeated between gasps of laughter.
"Please tell me that was an intentional pun." "Man, it could be. Maybe I was going to go on a whole rhapsody about my sexual relationship with the power of a good meal. I don't know, all my best work is off the cuff. You ruined my flow. Like a Disney Channel censor hitting the panic button before little Timmy said the fuck word and ruined his family-friendly image. How's he supposed to get slammed at the Teen Choice Awards if he can't be trusted on screen?"
Before Vriska could reply, John cut in.
"All right, you can help." He hesitated a moment, then continued, "But you gotta wear an apron, it's the rules."
He looked down at his own apron, then back up at Dave. Was he going to say something about it being too girly?
"Hell yeah, give me something vintage. Got a red one?"
Dave reached up, slotting his shades into place.
"Gotta rep the brand colors on this bacon show. Can be like Snoop on Martha Stewart and shit."
Vriska made a dismissive noise. He wished he were half as cool as Snoop. Instead of pushing back, Dave rolled with the jab. "Damn, you right. Would only that all of us could aspire to the D-O-double-G's supreme fucking chillmaster levels." John wished he could learn how to do that. He grabbed Dave a frilly picnic checkered apron from the back of the pantry door.
"All right, bro, just keep me away from that fucking oven because I don't trust myself to pass out of my feet right now,"
Dave said before releasing a massive yawn.
"Oh, shoot, do you want to sit down, Dave?"
John asked. Only just realizing Dave had spent the entire time he and Vriska were napping and recovering cleaning up his bro's apartment. Dave sat in a stool next to the island.
"Yeah, man, I'm set. Can't be a freeloader or nothing, though, so hand me a damn bowl to mix."
"Yeah." Vriska backed him up. "Let the conscript make some contributions." John sighed and pushed some eggs in the electric mixer with the whisk attachment over towards Dave.
"Think you could get these whites to stiff peaks?"
"Brother, all I do is make whites stiff," Dave boasted.
"Can you say anything that doesn't sound like a line from a low-budget porn?"
Vriska groaned. John and Dave smiled at each other over her discomfort. If it came to vetting a friend of Kanaya's, John was certain Dave would appreciate some assistance, putting her through the ringer. Equius. Equius snuggled against Nepeta as the two of them relaxed in their living room. They were in a sunken, cushion-filled space she'd called a conversation pit, which provided a comfortable surface and supported his impressive stature better than a couch could. Apparently it was an outdated piece of architecture, and Equius once again felt baffled at the human's consistent tendency to supersede excellent ideas with inferior ones. After the warming bliss of their shower, she demanded that he join her in the pit, curled up against him, and immediately fell asleep. Not wishing to disturb her, he had taken up one of her sketchbooks and began the drafting process for a second attempt at that root cellar. He'd drawn out the cellar itself in a simplistic scale diagram. In neat, blocked lettering surrounding the blueprint, he'd calculated the measurements of the various features, the size of the root cellar he wanted at least 20 by 20 feet, how deep he needed to dig 20 feet, the concrete needed to support the walls, assuming he purchased 80-pound bags, with each producing 0.60 cubic feet of concrete, how many bricks he'd need for the walls, assuming standard Besser block dimensions, the degree of the arch for the wooden skeleton of the roof, the cement needed to finish that roof, the amount of extra space to accommodate a stairwell, and making it such that he could easily traverse it. He blinked at the complexity,
the full diagram allowing him a better sense of scale. It was going to be a much more extensive process now that he'd thought about it more clearly. In the weeks and months after the catastrophe, the root cellars built by generations past of his clan had made all the difference. Though human infrastructure had managed to recover enough that Houston seemed to be in no danger of starvation times, Aquaeus knew better. He knew his father had sent him here, not only as a concession for his son's happiness, but also to secure a place of safety. Should the situation turn dire, with the strangeness occurring on the Pharaoh's border, the senators of his clan were all uneasy. He needed to do something, ingratiating himself with the Elders' Council, getting the favor of Houston's hunter. With the Kanaya situation, none of his political goals seemed currently feasible. Expanding his new property to grow crops, preparing a place to store cured meat and excess harvest, these things were feasible. Thankfully, their home abutted a large section of abandoned land, and it would be easy to requisition it. A few of the neighbors further down the block had knocked down their back fences to create a large community garden, but there was plenty of empty land for his purpose. Turning the page of the sketchbook, he began a new drawing, a plan for future crops. He'd never been involved in the crops back home, having spent more time learning politics than agriculture. But he knew that his father's ancestors, for all their Roman pride, had not brought the humble Hortus and Alera, nor the grandiose Calidarium, when they'd settled in the region between Nevada and the eastern edge of the Great Plains. After all, the land had not been empty, not of people, nor of culture. Just as the horse had evolved in the Americas, so had the centaur. While the ancient horse, Equus Scoti, had long gone extinct, the Equus Scoti Centaurus had remained. Wars between the Native American humans and centaurs had decimated the latter. The Equus Ferus Centaurus had made an alliance with their indigenous counterparts. Just as the mythological Zahak was he who has 10,000 horses, so would their clan grow if they became one people. The result had been a blending of cultures, with the Roman style of agriculture discarded. Instead, they had embraced the Three Sisters style of agriculture, cultivating a mixed field of maize, beans, and squash, while sunflowers and plum trees lined the outskirts. As he pondered, he sketched a field, trisected. The first section he labeled sweet corn and summer squash, the second, flint corn and pumpkin, the third, flower corn and winter squash. Above the field, he wrote, Hidatsa shield figure beans, drawing an arrow down into each section of the field. In the space dividing each section, as well as the border, he indicated the presence of sunflowers and Chickasaw plum. He wasn't sure if he could acquire all of the necessary seedlings here, but if he went to the library and the Home Depot's garden center, he should be able to acquire the information necessary to begin preparations. Perhaps he could arrange a visit to one of the southern herds if the pro-extra loyalty program was inadequate for his agricultural needs.
Ah, what a perfect catnap.
While he had been lost in thought, Nepeta had apparently awoken and now wormed her way free of him to stretch. Her physique was a few degrees less cougar, her muzzle shortening, the fur retreating from her eyes and mouth. But her hands were still large, powerful and clawed, her feet still distinctly paw-like. Though dense with muscle, she felt a fraction leaner, and as she stood, he thought she might have lost a small increment of height. As though following his train of thought, she spoke.
Sunset's come and gone while I slept. I guess the full moon is a westerly offer.
I don't think officially works as that pun, unfortunately, he replied with a smile. But yes, you slept for quite a while. I was content to let you rest, giving your sleepless night while the full moon was high in the sky.
He closed the sketchbook, setting aside his plans for later, and rose to stand alongside her.
I have no complaints. You'll make a perfect cuddle partner.
She grinned, her sharp teeth on display, her voice husky, among other things. Her eyes raked his form, and he felt a bead of sweat form from the power of her gaze, like a deer caught in the headlights.
Ah!
He shifted from hoof to hoof, hoping to redirect her instincts until they retired for the evening. Their earlier shower had been exciting. If they got distracted now, they could kiss their chance at productivity goodbye.
Are you still satiated from your hunts, or would you like me to try my hand at preparing a meal?
At his words, she winced. Her voice losing its sultry tone as she swore suddenly, a loud expletive that was incredibly inappropriate. Before he could admonish her, she spoke.
I totally forgot about the gator,
she caterwauled, a feature contorting with anguish, a strange sight on her feline face.
Oh no, it'll be too heavy for me to handle now.
Her tail lashed in irritation.
A gator?
He asked, confused by the sudden topic change.
Please elaborate.
I brought home a fresh kill, all nice and cold in a cooler. It's out on the front porch. I thought we could serve alligator steaks at the party. And if I get the hide tanned, perhaps Kanaya could use it for something fancy.
She scrambled out of the conversation pit onto the living room floor.
Can you help me bring her to the kitchen? We should process it sooner than later.
He carefully stepped up and out of the conversation pit as well.
If you believe you're unable to lift it, it must be a rather large specimen,
he stated mildly as he began following her towards the front door.
I commend you on your hunting prowess.
She reached the front door and opened it, turning to look at him as she did so. Her eyes sparkled as she beamed at him.
Ah, Echo. It was a stroke of good luck. Stumbling across a gator like that so close to sunrise, I was able to make a super clean kill.
She held the door open, and he took it as a gesture to step outside first, hunching to avoid the doorframe. The porch was sheltered from the elements by an awning, but the rain itself was gone, and a thick wall of fog had taken its place. All the sounds and smells of the world were dampened beyond their doorstep, their front yard and beyond enveloped by the mist. The cooler was beside the welcome mat as promised, though the design was unfamiliar, dissimilar to the one in the garage. Its lid bowed outward slightly, casting the structural integrity of the plastic into doubt. As she followed him outside, he walked around so that he faced one of the side handles, while she took up position next to the other.
Where did you acquire this cooler? Did you plant it in advance somewhere on your territory? I should do that, but no. I bought it off some human going out on a hunt, which was pretty lucky. He had a bunch of ice already. All he had to do was make the gator fit. Oh, that is lucky. Ready.
They both reached down for the cooler's handles, lifting in unison. He wanted a grunt of exertion, muscles straining with the sheer mass they were dealing with. She wanted a similar sound, with a hint of a growl to it as she lifted. The cooler rose slightly higher on her end, lessening the burden for him as she put her predator's strength to work. The muscles of her forelimbs were beautiful through her fur.
To the kitchen,
she announced cheerily, and carefully began inching back through the doorway, bending down to avoid knocking her head against the doorframe. He slowly walked forward, matching her step for step, and the two began the trek to the kitchen. After he cleared the door, he stretched out a hind leg to deliver a gentle kick, his other limbs trembling as his balance shifted. But with the sound of shod hoof on solid oak, the door slammed shut. As they entered the kitchen, Petty directed their path towards the stretch of countertop framing the sink.
Before we can skin it, I think it could use a scrub,
she mused, brow furrowed in thought.
If we place it on the counter, we can use the plastic bristle brush I bought for the pants and get all the mud off the scales.
They had reached their destination, and the two lowered the cooler to the floor carefully. The sound it made against the tile was still enough to make him wince, concerned that the weight had cracked them.
That sounds like a good idea.
He leaned down once more, reaching for the latch on the cooler.
Let me just...
He flipped the latch just as she took a sharp inhale of breath.
No, wait!
But it was too late. He'd unlatched the cooler, and before he had time to think, a blur of yellowed teeth and dark scales sprang from the confines, swinging upwards as though propelled until the large, cold, and heavy head slammed directly into him, face first. He stumbled backwards, his face a bruising mass of pain, eyes full of stars as he put up his hands and reared onto his hind legs to defend from the unexpected assault. His hands and front hooves made contact with the cold, wet scales that he shoved, his rear hooves skittering on the tile in his haste to retreat. His nostrils were filled with the smell of blood. He heard the distinct sound of Nepeta shouting an expletive and a wet, meaty thud as his assailant hit the ground. His vision had not yet cleared when clawed hands were wrapped around his forelegs, bearing down as one would on the bridle of a bucking bronco, forcing him to place his front hooves on the ground and stop his desperate flailing.
Nepeta, I thought you said you'd killed it!
He felt her hands leave his legs, but he was more focused on a futile attempt to rub his eyes back to clarity.
I did! I'm so sorry, I should have warned you. I had to fold it into thirds to fit. It was too long. It's not alive, but I guess the body wasn't happy being crammed like that.
The spots were slowly fading, allowing him to glimpse her furred face full of love and concern.
I feel as though I have been punched directly in the face.
He spoke in stilted words, made nasally by the blood clogging his nostrils.
Have I lost another tooth?
The taste of blood in his mouth was concerning, though he was unsure where it had come from. He opened his mouth for her inspection, lifting his top lip with his thumbs.
No, but your nose is bleeding something awful.
He released his lips as her right hand gently moved to his face, brushing lightly against his sore and tender cheeks, before trailing down his nose.
Not broken, at least.
Despite the pain, he couldn't help but lean into her touch.
I'm really sorry,
she spoke, forlornly, eyes downcast.
It's quite all right, I healed fast. It was simply unexpected. Let me help you lift it onto the counter, and then I'll tend to my bruises.
At his words, she took a careful step back, giving him room to see the culprit lying on the floor. Sweet fiddlesticks, you are a marvel, he spoke with awe, his eyes glued to the behemoth sprawled at their feet. It far exceeded the length of his body and, though flattened, its girth rivaled his own. I'm getting my tape measure. Nosebleed forgotten, he turned tail, hurrying to the master bedroom where his tool bag lay abandoned, dripping wet in the sink. He quickly extracted his tape measure, shaking moisture from it impatiently, and returned to the kitchen.
We do hold the end to his nose.
He presented the tape measure to Nepeta, who grabbed the end as instructed.
Sure, you have got me curious.
They both kneeled down, her holding the end of the measure against the tip of the nose while he slowly scooted backwards towards the tail, pulling the tape out inch by inch. When he reached the tail, he tucked it straight, then rested the measure against the tip.
12 feet 3 inches, he pronounced reverently. You caught a bull.
It looks bigger than I remember it.
She was crouched, staring directly into the clouded eyes of her prey.
Look at those teeth. I bet they crush bone.
She had her hands on the top and bottom jaw opening and closing the mouth as she spoke. Excitement rang in her voice as though the danger she had been in was the coolest thing ever. For Equius, he felt his heartbeat skyrocket for a moment, the thought of his beloved finding her beautiful limbs crushed in the jaws of this disgusting reptile powerful enough to sicken him.
Thankfully, you are the superior hunter, of course,
he replied stiffly, not wishing to let his anxiety bleed into his voice.
Now let us place the beast on the counter so that we may prepare it for carving.
He looked down at his hands, frowning at the mud that streaked them from his moments touching the reptile. At least the wounds in his hand were healed, with no mud touching raw flesh. He was sure his face was smeared as well, as his chest had more than a few clay-covered stains.
I suppose it would have been too unwieldy to clean it before transporting.
I was in the middle of nowhere, pretty much. I didn't want to spend any more time away from you than absolutely necessary.
The pure sincerity in her voice made his breath catch in his throat, as it always did.
Ah, well, I cannot protect your priorities, as I would have done the same.
She wanted a throaty purr at that, a sound that reached deep within him.
Oh, good,
she pronounced smugly, looking at him with an intensity that pinned him in place.
You are mine.
He flushed deeply and felt the sweat quicken on his brow.
All yours, he replied softly.
I keep getting distracted. Let's get this thing on the counter before I give up and pounce you.
Her flash of sharp teeth was sending his instincts ablaze, and he quivered at her words.
Yes, let us prepare the meat before it turns.
He moved to the gator's hindquarters, sliding his hands under its belly.
Ready?
He knew she was not, and waited patiently, forcing himself to stillness as she inched around the head and moved closer, her own hands going under the chest.
Ready!
They both pushed off the ground, heaving the gator up off the floor. His muscles flared in complaint at the weight. Even without the additional pounds of cooler and ice, it was a force to be reckoned with. They swung it onto the counter, its head loose and lolling down into the sink at an unnatural angle.
I broke its neck without damaging the hide.
There was a note of pride in her voice as she tucked the body further into the sink.
I wonder what color its scales really are under all that muck.
She grabbed the brush she'd spoken about.
While I'm cleaning the scales, can you sharpen a good knife for skinning and rinse out the cooler with the hose? I don't think all of this meat is going to fit in our fridge or freezer.
She turned on the sink, wetting the plastic bristles and the mud-caked head of the gator, then began to scrub. He gave the beast an appraising look, wondering just how heavy it was, 700, 800 pounds. Even discounting the skin, bones, and unpalatable organs, he had a feeling she was right, it wouldn't all fit.
Certainly, I will...
The sound of his phone ringing caught him mid-sentence. The sound was distinctive, a peal of sound that he'd assigned to a single contact.
If you don't take that, he is going to call again,
she said wryly. Better see what your dad wants.
I'll take my leave for a moment,
he replied, already moving. The phone was in the living room, he was pretty sure.
I'll return to assist post haste.
Don't worry, I can handle my prey. Tell him I said hi.
Her voice followed him as he left the room, hurrying towards the sound. Just as it reached its final ring, he snatched it up off the floor in the conversation pit and hit the accept button.
Hello.
He placed the phone on speaker, settling in the pit with his requisitioned sketchbook in case he needed to take notes.
Epaphroditus, there you are. I thought you were going to signal to your old father to voicemail.
Though his tone was pleasant, there was a hint of reprimand to the statement. One does not send their principale magistratum executiva to voicemail, no matter the strength of their relation.
My apologies. I was occupied with the bounty of Nepeta's hunt.
I hope you aren't relying entirely on her sustenance. The girl is a fine enough hunter, but you require a more balanced diet.
He was pretty sure this was his father's idea of small talk, that or his clunky way of reassuring himself that his son was taking care of himself.
Of course not. I have plans to turn the land into a proper field, grow some staple crops. The humans offer interesting culinary services, but their lack of proper squash is abysmal. His father chuckled at that.
I never imagined you'd miss squash, but that is not why I've called.
Whoops, this was the part where Aqueous should have already asked what the nature of the conversation was meant to be. Why have you called, sir?
To give you an update on that rather abysmal situation with our Nevada border. Satsuket is not the only member of the Pharaoh's kingdom to stray beyond her borders. A few ranking members of the Salt Lake herd went missing last month, do you recall?
Aqueous furrowed his brow, trying to recall the list of the missing. The Zahak clan was 10,000 strong, and he was not familiar with each and every member of each individual herd. Yes, sir. Senator Apampi's twins, Sakup and Piora. The brother is one of our better archers, and his sister excels in the Bacchanal Mysteries. The survival of both twins had been a rarity, a story of defying the odds that had ensured he remembered them. They were inseparable. They were also his second cousins on his mother's side, a fact his father surely recalled, but it would be improper to mention in the context of governing. He could not show favoritism.
Precisely. Their disappearance, it devastated both their father and the wider community. The others that have gone missing are all in my age range. The twins are barely a year your senior.
He knew this. They often spent time together when coming to and from diplomatic meetings with Pharaoh Serket. He shared a passing similarity to his older cousins. They had similarly strong noses and raven black hair. Their pelts were a similar shade of gray. But while he was tall and short-furred, they were stocky, with a thicker coat and the distinctive stripes adorning the legs of their Equus Scotti Centaurus ancestors. Sir, did they meet with foul play?
We think they've been ritually turned by one of the Pharaoh's lieutenants. A large group slipped by the border guards unnoticed, and when the trail was discovered, hoofprints and burnt grape leaves were among the footprints.
Aqueous winced. The presence of grape leaves was damning. Only his species could wield the bacchanal methods of concealment, which involved the burning of grape leaves where the targets could breathe in the smoke. The confusion-based illusions it produced befuddled the senses. It could certainly be used to cross a border without following the proper protocol.
Sir, why would Piora do such a thing? I don't recall her having any desire to become a vampire.
That was an understatement. She had been disgusted by their leech neighbors, thought they were a parasitic blight. Sakup had a more neutral opinion, but always sided with his sister when the topic was broached within her hearing range. His father sighed wearily.
Ritual-born mind vampires are not always made by choice, nor are they always given much in the way of free will when their progenitor sets the parameters for their transformation, you know that.
Aqueous's heart sank. He did know that in theory. But being told that it was a possibility was far different from being informed that his own relatives had fallen prey to such a devastating violation. To have the twins stripped of their true personalities, to have their goals replaced with that of their creator, he felt grief welling up, a fresh wave of it. The people he had known were gone, but instead of dying with their dignities intact, they would be enslaved.
I don't understand. His voice shook. What reason would the Pharaoh have? Is that not a violation of our treaty?
Does our treaty have any force, with 3 years of silence and untraversable terrain between us?
His father countered.
I don't know the details of the turn. I know better than to ask, but it must be particularly involved to take a full cycle of the moon. Well, it's possible this was spearheaded by a rogue agent, perhaps leading Piora to conceal defectors while they fled across the country. I do not know how they could conceal two adult centaurs without being noticed by their pharaoh. Even if they forced her to use her magic the entire time. The Pharaoh has a door inside the minds of all her subjects, and the priest has her own ways of ensuring that nothing escapes her scrutiny.
So you think it was with her blessing? His voice felt hollow.
Or under her orders.
His father sighed again.
How is the wayward heir? Is Miss Chica recovering from her injuries?
Aqueous sucked the air through his teeth, the unfortunate events of the past days recalled. He did his best to regain his composure, speaking in the same cadence as though he was reporting on the results of a hunt.
Vriska's recovering well from her physical injuries under the watchful eye and promised sanctuary of the hunter. She has admitted to me that she suffered from some degree of amnesia regarding the last 3 years. Though she recalls the initial escape and her time since falling into Carcass River, she stated that she was experiencing holes in her recollection.
That is unfortunate. I was hoping to get a first-hand account of the state of her pharaoh's territory.
He paused, then continued.
I am glad to hear she is recovering physically, of course, but we could have used the information.
Of course. There is some hope that her memories will return as she recovers. I had plans to acquire a book from the public library on surviving extreme conditions, as well as one on traumatic memory loss. Perhaps the humans have some idea of what ails her.
That's very good of you.
Aqueous felt the silence stretch between them. His father was waiting for something. What had he forgotten?
I will also be sure to ask her what she recalled of the Pharaoh's plans in the days leading up to the catastrophe. He offered the statement hesitantly. If she was preparing to run away, it's possible she was hoping to avoid involvement in something specific rather than simply...
Rather than hoping to escape her duty to her family and her people.
His father's voice was level, but Aqueous still felt as though he'd been scolded.
So she was not... I mean to say, it is not a matter of dereliction of duty. If she had been a filly in your herd, you would have taken her from her mother's house and placed her elsewhere. The parent has a duty to the child first, a duty which Ferrisaket had no qualms with neglecting.
He fought to keep his tone civil. He had not wished to betray his friend's confidence when she was trapped, and he had seen no point when he had thought her dead. Knowing she had escaped successfully, he had no reason to pretend that the Pharaoh loved or cared for her daughter.
I see.
Aqueous doubled down.
Vriska was not given the kindness a child deserves. She was made to participate in the darkest acts of cruelty.
He spoke stiffly.
I will not go into detail without her express permission, but... There is a reason she spent 3 years on the run. And it was not because she tired of learning politics.
Son.
Aqueous stopped speaking.
I believe you. There is no need to go on. I have other matters to attend to, but I will call again soon. Please speak to Vriska and see what she recalls. If she permits you to share, I would be interested in learning what harms she has suffered.
Thank you, sir. I will do so.
Good. Are you well? Are you... content?
His father sounded embarrassed, as though realizing he should have asked sooner. He couldn't fault him, but with the responsibilities weighing heavily on his father's mind.
Yes. I am grateful for the opportunity you have afforded me. Life in a city is an adjustment, but sharing a home with Nepeta, I am more than content. I am happy.
That is a relief. I know you have missed her.
In the background of his father's audio, a muffled voice deepened. The gruff shouted something unintelligible. His father swore quietly.
Well, there goes my free time. I must go. Send a message to me with any further information. I love you.
His voice had an apologetic tone.
I will keep you apprised. I love you.
There was another muffled shout, and then his father hung up unceremoniously, leaving Aqueous alone in silence. Well, he might as well share what he'd learned with Nepeta. He was sure she was curious. She always was. Kanaya. Kanaya spoke quietly with Mama. The lab was beginning to feel familiar, a prospect Kanaya reviled almost as much as this transformation that had befallen her. Mama wanted her to come home, but Kanaya did not want to risk the threat of unknown changes in her curse brought on by the setting sun. The hunter seemed to agree.
Yes, no, yes, the doctor fell into her office chair. Kanaya must remain here for at the minimum a full 24 hours. If I had no heart, I would keep her under lock and key for the progression of a full lunar cycle to observe any changes with the auspicious nature of the moon. But I have a feeling she'll be fine. So, who'd like to require bedding for the patient while I set up some diagnostic equipment to keep tabs on her overnight?
The doctor smiled at Mama and the hunter. Neither of them seemed inclined to humor her distastefully bubbly approach to the situation, but Mama turned to Kanaya and spoke. I'll fetch the bedding and blankets and pillows from home. Do you need anything else, dear?
Thank you, Mama.
Kanaya whispered, then looked down at her hands. She needed, more than anything else, to get a handle on her body, some taste of normalcy if she could manage it.
My sewing kit, she asked hesitantly. The travel one.
Mama nodded immediately. Of course. I'll be right back, and I plan to spend the night in the hotel. I won't be far, sweetheart. With a kiss pressed to Kanaya's forehead, Mama left on her mission.
Great, once she's back and you're tucked in, I can start fixing the nodes, the doctor said,
fiddling with the configuration of some neurological monitoring device with a number of electrode cables that rivaled the heads of a hydra. As if Kanaya wasn't going to have enough trouble sleeping. The hunter's foot started tapping on the lab floor again. He'd seemed distracted the entire time he was supposedly guarding her.
I'll be to have a sleepover, Mr. Strada,
Kanaya said, hiding her bitterness in a healthy dose of sarcasm. The hunter looked up at her.
No. I don't like all the movement and reports I've been getting from the city while I've been watching you like some kind of nuclear warhead. I especially don't like how the elders decided to mobilize 40% of the city to track you, and subsequently me.
That kind of broadcast can only stir up trouble. Well, my deepest apologies for the inconvenience of my death, Kanaya said. The hunter's mouth pressed into a thin line. Kanaya. I don't regret what I did to protect Dave and the others. Don't think for a second that means I don't regret what happened to you and how my negligence played a part in it, your family. Kanaya froze at the sincerity with which Mr. Strider spoke. She felt a spike of shame for offloading her frustrations onto him. Before she could return a more empathetic reply, his phone rang again. Though the tone was not the same as the last emergency call, he seemed to hesitate, looking at the caller ID before accepting the call. Strider, he said, sounding official with the proclamation of his surname. His brows knit as the caller spoke. That's improbable, he said. The Centaurs have long-standing treaties and alliances with them. And there was even talk of binding marriages. The caller spoke more. Kanaya noted that despite Vriska's vampire theory in regards to her curse, she didn't seem to have any sort of enhanced hearing as the mind vampire did. As such, she couldn't make out the quiet, garbled phone call. Her questioning was inconclusive. Amnesia, as I reported, he said. Kanaya swallowed. Were they talking about Vriska? Kanaya, be a darling and let me measure the circumference of your skull. The doctor suddenly interrupted Kanaya's eavesdropping. What? Why? Kanaya sounded more hostile than she'd intended. Did wizardry involve phrenology? I just need to ensure my electrodes and psionic sensors won't overlap. There's a low chance of it, but as you're on the smaller side... Kanaya got up and walked over to the doctor, bending her head down dramatically. Oh, excellent. The doctor wrapped a measuring tape around her brow and the furthest extended back of her skull. As I thought, not a problem, the doctor hummed, and returned to configuring another advanced-looking piece of equipment. Just how many sleep studies did this lady perform? When Kanaya turned back, she was dismayed to see the hunter sliding his phone back into his pocket. She'd missed the rest of the conversation. I need to run, he said, standing up. By all means. The doctor waved him off. It's not as though you've been doing anything, she added quietly. What is it? Kanaya asked. Something more dangerous than a nuclear warhead? The hunter's expression didn't change. Something that could be. I need to be the one to determine that. He began walking to the lab exit. Kanaya called out, banking on her intuition. Vriska is in a delicate place. Please take care. And be gentle if you intend to ask about her past. The hunter paused at the door, his head tipping down. It was less than a second, but as he lifted it again and continued marching to the elevator, Kanaya knew she'd been heeded. She plopped back down on the seat, feeling the exact opposite of excitement to be left alone in the laboratory with the doctor. You know, Dr. Lalonde said, as though called by Kanaya's thoughts, we could run some preemptive tests and start the diagnostic fluid injections while we're waiting. Kanaya wished she was still able to breathe. If only for the relief a deep, tired exhale often brought. For now it was only a pantomime. Some memory of what her body once expressed innately. A thought briefly passed in her mind as the doctor menacingly approached her with needles and tubes. She was capable of falling to unconsciousness, but was she capable of sleep?
For the full text of this and other stories by the same authors, visit the AO3 pages of Madam Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Constant Conquest by Michael Guy Bowman. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is located at sangabrielvo.com. And there you can learn about other stories that I've read, my Discord server, and ways to support what I do. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.